Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
$500,000 is a pretty good paycheck by most people's standards, unless you're used to making much, much more. Earlier this year, the White House said half a mil ought to be enough for executives at companies getting government bailouts. This morning, though, Treasury Secretary Geithner said, never mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Wednesday, the 10th of June, and it is, as always, great to have you here. It's not that the White House and the Treasury Department don't want to regulate executive compensation. They are just going to go about it a little bit differently than they first thought. Today, the Obama administration appointed what it's calling a special master to manage the salaries of the top 25 executives at companies that have taken federal bailout money. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
Wall Street banks complain bitterly that the government shouldn't meddle with pay packages and that caps put them at a competitive disadvantage when attracting and keeping talented executives. Today, Secretary Geithner agreed.
We do not believe it's appropriate for the government to set caps on compensation. We are not going to prescribe detailed prescriptive rules for compensation.
Instead, Geithner endorsed giving stockholders an annual vote on the pay packages of the top five executive officers of all companies, not just banks. The votes would be non-binding on boards of directors. But shareholders' say-on-pay votes don't sit well with many corporate managers. They say a simple salary number is incomplete. The Center on Executive Compensation represents HR executives at big companies. Senior Vice President Tim Bartle says shareholder votes done right are impractical for most investors.
If you're looking at a large institutional investor or even a mom-and-pop investor, that needs to read through 30 to 50 pages of comp disclosures for each company. It's pretty difficult to come up with a meaningful view on pay for each of those firms.
Advocates of salary limits say pay-for-performance incentives at banks encouraged excessive risk-taking. But Ira Kay at the management consulting firm Watson Wyatt says only some incentives encourage bad executive behavior.
We think companies should protect their core cash and stock incentives, but that they should be very flexible on the shareholder irritants such as perquisites and excessive severance, which some people call pay for failure.
Kay is just completing a large study which concludes it wasn't pay incentives that prompted risky executive behavior. Instead, he says managers were using broken business models that hid where the real risks were. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Here's today's reminder that we live in a global economy, and for parts of it anyway, a fragile economy it is at that. I've got the foreign exchange markets in mind at the moment and the fate of the U.S. dollar today. The greenback got beat up a bit earlier this morning after the deputy chairman of the Russian Central Bank did some thinking out loud. He said Moscow might cut back on its investment in U.S. government bonds at a time, remember, when the U.S. Treasury is trying to sell record amounts of that debt. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The Russians hold one-third of their $400 billion reserves in U.S. treasuries. That gives them a keen interest in the fate of the U.S. dollar. Francis Bennington runs Inspiro Asset Management. He says the Russians have a major concern about America's public finances.
With substantial fiscal deficits going as far as the eye can see, that the dollar will come under significant pressure and will be forced to devalue, making them significant losses on their foreign exchange reserve.
The Russian Central Bank said it would like to shift some of its dollar reserves into bonds issued by the International Monetary Fund. The bonds would be pegged to the IMF's basket of currencies called special drawing rights. Charles Movit of IHS Global Insight says the Russian motives are political as well as economic.
There's a political aim to reinforce the image across the globe that it's no longer a unipolar world, that Russia and countries like Russia increasingly matter.
Economically, Russia matters much less than China, but, says Movit, China has also cast doubt on the dollar.
certainly there's a psychological impact because other countries, namely China, have also expressed their concerns about the focus of the world economy on the dollar.
Russia plans to discuss the role of the dollar next week with its partners in the BRIC group, Brazil, India and China. This is not merely a matter of prestige for the US. America needs to sell hundreds of billions of dollars worth of bonds. It can ill afford a loss of confidence in its currency. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Not to get too far down into the bond market weeds on you here, but the Treasury auctioned off a new set of 10-year notes today. Wound up having to pay quite a bit more interest than they'd expected. A sign, perhaps, that the market here is as worried about those rising federal deficits as the Russians are. The Senate is considering a piece of legislation that would regulate the tobacco industry. The House has already passed its version of the landmark bill, and President Obama, who's been known to take a puff or two in the past, is expected to sign it. The bill's a big deal because for the first time, it's going to let the Food and Drug Administration regulate tobacco as a drug. But Sarah Gardner reports it's not at all clear how much cigarettes are going to change.
This legislation gives the Food and Drug Administration authority over tobacco products for the first time ever. American Cancer Society lobbyist Greg Hafley says it's about time.
The tobacco industry has been an industry that is in the business of producing, marketing, and selling addiction, disease, and death-causing products.
Under this bill, the FDA would impose sweeping new limits on tobacco advertising, especially to kids. It would demand more explicit and bigger warning labels and ban advertising terms like low tar or mild. Health advocates say those are misleading. But it also gives the government power to limit the levels of nicotine and other ingredients in tobacco products.
We believe that FDA regulations could provide some clear guidelines and some oversight of products that could potentially reduce the harm caused by smoking.
That's no anti-tobacco crusader. That's Bill Phelps of Philip Morris, the nation's largest cigarette maker. The company not only supports this legislation, it helped shape it. But Philip Morris won't say whether it's already started reformulating its brands. Other cigarette makers didn't get back to us. Meantime, health advocates are skeptical FDA regulation will result in a safer cigarette.
It's kind of like trying to push a balloon into a box that isn't quite big enough.
That's researcher and anti-tobacco activist Stanton Glantz at UC San Francisco.
You can push down the levels of one thing or another, but in doing that, you usually push up the level of other bad things.
Glantz worries Congress has made too many concessions in this legislation, like letting the tobacco industry sit on a scientific advisory panel. Other political compromises were probably inevitable, like no outright ban on nicotine. That's the stuff that makes cigarettes so addictive. Matthew Myers is president of Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids.
We've tried prohibition before. Prohibition of an addictive product with 40 million American users won't produce a public health benefit.
That's 40 million smokers and falling. But the tobacco industry can still count on the rest of the world. Last year, Philip Morris International sold over 800 billion cigarettes. Bigger sales are expected in 2009. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Not much smoke or a fire on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. After a 24-hour delay courtesy of the U.S. Supreme Court, Chrysler and Fiat didn't waste any time this morning closing their deal. 42 days after it entered Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, the new Chrysler came out this morning lighter by billions of dollars in debt and free of 789 underperforming dealerships. Both Chrysler and General Motors have said they want to dramatically reduce the number of dealers to cut costs and become more competitive. Commentator David Frum says it's about time.
Americans don't like the auto bailouts. That dislike does credit to the people's understanding of a market economy. It also represents payback time for decades of unhappy motorist experiences with the Detroit 3. Too many Americans have bought too many bad cars. But it's not just the product that is the problem. It is the car buying process. Some years ago, the car rating service Edmunds.com sent a writer to work undercover in a car dealership. Here's his first meeting with potential customers. I gave them a cheerful good afternoon. They turned and in an instant I saw the fear on their faces. What were they afraid of? They were afraid they would be cheated, ripped off, pressured, hoodwinked, swindled, jacked around, suckered, or fleeced. American business excels at retail. Low, predictable, clearly marked prices in low-pressure environments. Except autos. A shopping experience more like medieval Damascus than like modern Walmart or Home Depot. The source of the evil is the dealership system. The big idea in American retailing since Montgomery met Ward was to accept lower margins in return for higher volume. Cars and trucks, however, are sold through a vast network of dealerships, 43,000 of them at last count. Even at the top of the home refinancing bull market, that translated into one dealer for every 500 vehicles sold. Too many dealers are trying to squeeze too much profit out of too few customers. We need a revolution in auto selling to match the revolution that Toyota has brought to auto manufacture. Fewer dealers, lower margins, more predictable prices, no more aftermarket ripoffs, a clearer separation of the cost of purchase from the cost of financing. Car selling awaits its Sam Walton, somebody who can figure out that when consumers cease to dread the showroom, they might buy more of the cars shown.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Do take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Death to potatoes doesn't roll off the tongue like yes we can or are you better off today than you were 4 years ago. But potatoes is the campaign slogan of the day in Iran. Presidential elections there are set for Friday. Anti-government students say President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is trying to buy votes by giving out free vegetables to the poor, hence the potato thing. The economy is the big issue in this campaign. His critics say Ahmadinejad is messing it up. The other candidates who are running, they promise, well, change you can believe in. Reese Ehrlich went to Tehran's Central Bazaar to find out more.
Small motorcycles piled precariously high with goods drive through narrow alleyways. They zoom past men pushing huge metal carts filled with tightly rolled Persian carpets. Usually bustling this time of year, sections of Tehran's massive bazaar are almost empty. Majid Tehrani is prowling the alleys in search of customers.
We have the collection of nomadic carpets, if it's interesting for you to visit. Because my brother's name is in the Lonely Planet.
Once he's convinced that selling me a carpet is a waste of time, he switches to fulminating against government economic policy.
The inflation goes up every other month. You know, it has so influence on our work because the people cannot buy the carpet. They do not have enough money for spend the carpet, you know.
Tehrani says he used to support President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, but has decided to cast his vote for the leading reformist candidate, Mir Hussein Mousavi. The slogan, "It's the economy, stupid," isn't trotted out much here, but Iranians get the concept. They blame the incumbent administration for 11% unemployment and a slow economic growth that has reached recession levels. Shopper Masuma Yahya is dressed conservatively in a black chador. She works as a clerk for a charitable organization.
4 years ago, I voted for Mr. Ahmadinejad. But since then, I haven't been happy with what he's done. When I visit people's homes, I see the illness, poverty, and bankruptcies caused by the recession.
She plans to vote for Mohsen Rezaei, a conservative who promises strict fiscal discipline. President Ahmadinejad draws strong support from poor Iranians, a sector of the business elite, and the country's powerful security services. Economic journalist and book author Bahman Ahmadi says the president has pursued 4 years of populism in which he handed out billions of dollars in subsidies to the poor. But the money wasn't invested in creating jobs.
People say, all right, he's given us money. They don't know that this money in their pocket causes more inflation.
Hassan Gulani has turned his cell phone shop into a volunteer Ahmadinejad campaign office. People rush about, haggling over cell phone prices, and then grab some election posters. Gulani admits the economy has gone south, but he says Ahmadinejad isn't to blame.
He hasn't been able to achieve his goals 100% because of some problems caused by other organizations, not the government. The U.S. is to blame because of its sanctions against Iran.
Ahmadinejad accuses all his opponents of corruption, while they say he's destroying the country's economy and foreign policy. It's not clear who the public will believe. If no candidate wins over 50% of the vote on June 12th, the top two contenders face a runoff 1 week later. In Tehran, Omri Serlik for Marketplace.
Coming up, sizing up the benefits of being tall.
If you look at society, that's $170 billion of income moving from the shortest quartile to the tallest quartile every year.
But first, let's do the numbers. What started as a real market downer ended as just your average down day. The Dow Industrials dipped 24 points today, a quarter of 1%, closed at 8,739. The NASDAQ slipped a third of 1%, 7 points. Ended at 1853. The S&P 500 forfeited one-third of 1%, 3 points, finished at 939. Fears over rising interest rates that I mentioned sent financial stocks lower. J.P. Morgan Chase gave back 1 2/10% today. Bank of America lost 2/3%. Goldman Sachs withdrew 1 3/4%. Oil stuck to its new storyline. Crude prices surged to a 7-month high today. Energy stocks returned the favor. Chevron was up a fraction. ConocoPhillips took on about 0.5%. ExxonMobil rose nearly 1%. Bond prices rose, as I said. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.95%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Super Brands, Brand Week's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brand Week Super Brands for more information. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for the month of May. The Senate Indian Affairs Committee discusses reforming the health care system for Native Americans. The hearing takes place as broader health care reform for all Americans is under consideration. And the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival opens in New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You probably could have figured this would happen as the recession really took hold last year, but 2008 was only the second time there has been a year-over-year drop in charitable giving in this country in the past half century. Giving USA released those numbers today. But with the decline of outright charity have come other ways to get money into the hands of those who need it. Microfinance is one of those ways. Small loans and financial services to the poor and economically underserved. It's been huge in the developing world, and it's gone online, too. There are a number of websites out there that help Internet users fund entrepreneurs from Kenya to Cambodia. Today, one of the biggest of those sites, Kiva.org, will let users make microloans to small business owners right here in the United States. Rachel Dornhelm reports.
In January of this year, Vika Sinapada fulfilled a long-time dream. She opened her own business, assisting the elderly.
So usually in the afternoon, I just make her tea.
On this day, she's at a client's house outside San Francisco.
Make her sandwiches.
Sinapada says she had the idea for the business after taking care of her own relatives. What she didn't have was a line of credit.
I've tried the route through the bank, and, you know, they want 2 years of experience. And especially for myself, I didn't really have much of any foundation as far as experience other than just my MBA and background in sales, and it wasn't enough.
So she launched her business with her savings, $5,000. In March, she realized she needed another $10,000 for a license from the state and more marketing materials. And that's how she became a part of an experiment on the microlending website Kiva.org. Kiva is a nonprofit that allows individuals to lend to entrepreneurs around the world in $25 increments. Until today, all of its borrowers were in developing countries.
The economy and the credit crisis was a big motivator for Kiva looking at the United States and realizing, wow, there's actually quite a need for capital domestically.
Premal Shah is president of Kiva.
So say someone in Queens, New York who might want to start a salon or someone here in the Bay Area that might want to start, you know, a daycare.
Microcredit in the U.S. has existed for two decades, but it gets less attention here than in the rest of the world. The average U.S. loan is $7,000 compared to a few hundred abroad. And relative need may be perceived differently, too.
I really don't know if people are going to say, hey, my $25 goes further in South Sudan or in Cambodia than it does in, say, Queens, New York. It'll be really interesting to watch.
Shaw says Kiva users do show strong preferences, and funding rates vary depending on the borrower's gender and geography.
For example, if you're an a Kenyan woman farmer, you get funded 10.2 times faster than a male Bulgarian taxi driver.
To test the waters, Kiva is having two U.S. microfinance institutions post their entrepreneurs' profiles online. Eric Weaver is CEO of one of them, the Opportunity Fund in San Jose. It vetted Vika Sinapada's loan. Weaver says after the credit market seized up, they've seen more interest in microloans.
We're seeing more people come to us who previously were bankable. You know, they've had their line of credit frozen or their term loan was not renewed. They weren't able to, you know, increase the credit they're getting from the bank.
So would a current Kiva user be interested in the U.S. option? I called up Reverend David Taylor in Greenville, South Carolina. His Eastminster Presbyterian Church currently lends on Kiva.
Actually, on our outreach team, we've had conversations about how we could do a Kiva-like loan to people in the community.
Reverend Taylor says his congregation would probably be most interested in funding U.S. entrepreneurs from their own region. People across the country may have that option. If all goes well, Kiva plans to team up with microfinance organizations in Detroit, New Orleans, and beyond. In San Francisco, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
There are all kinds of reasons why one might be successful in life and work, or less than completely successful. Drive, intelligence, economic opportunity. Also, in some cases, how tall you are. Height can play a big part in whether the chips fall in your favor or not. Ariane Cohen explores that notion in her new book called The Tall Book, A Celebration of Life from On High. Ariane, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Is there a textbook definition of what it means to be tall? I mean, people look at me and I'm 6'1", and people say, wow, you're tall. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, sometimes.
Generally, you're tall if you're in the top 20th percentile, although you're tall if you're taller than the people around you. I mean, it's relative.
Where did this book come from? What happened to you to write this book?
My entire life, I have been super tall, and there was no book about it. And I really wanted to understand it and sort of make a book that was a kind of fun, foundational knowledge for tall people. This being said, what ended up happening is sort of a book about success and kind of how to succeed and how you can kind of trace when people are succeeding and when they're not.
And there is this sort of thought out there that tall people generally have it easier. You guys, you make more money, you are more successful, you're regarded as, you know, rich and handsome and all that stuff.
The truth is, I mean, tall people, they do make more money. They make $789 more per inch per year. They live a little bit longer, and there's a really minor, mild IQ boost. But that's it. They are not nicer. They are not prettier. They are not anything else. But they've sort of gotten a halo in society at this point.
But $789 per inch per year, I mean, you know, it can add up to a couple of thousand dollars.
It absolutely does. And it's kind of a funny joke on an individual basis. But if you look at society, that's 170 $170 billion of income moving from the shortest quartile to the tallest quartile every year, which is huge. I mean, that's almost empire building. But what it also means is that tall people are a hugely undervalued market group. We do a lot of one-size-fits-all products. And it's something that I think every consumer company should be looking at, because tall people, I mean, not only are they successful, they have a lot of money, and they're not a well-served group.
All right, you know what I'm thinking now, though?
Yeah.
I'm thinking we need to tax you guys more.
You know, right? Some Harvard guys thought this too, Kai. You're right on the same page as the smartest economists in the country. Two guys named Gregory Mankiw and Matthew Windsor, all their Harvard economists, they wrote a paper a couple years ago saying that tall people should be taxed more. And the reason is economists think that our tax system is making up for the inability to tax talent and ability. Mm. So economists are always kind of seduced by the idea that, wow, tall people consistently make more money, so we should tax them. I find this kind of offensive as a tall person. Luckily, I think that a lot of Congress does too. Congress is filled with six-footers. In fact, over half of our senators are 6 foot or above.
Are there things that people who don't necessarily have the advantage of height can do to sort of, well, not pretend, but make up for it in a way and sort of have that bearing and command in meetings and in the workplace?
Absolutely. The number one thing that people need to do is act like a leader. Tall people tend to act like a leader from a very young age because other children relate to them like a slightly older peer. So they're just always the leader from, you know, age six on. And in the workplace, when you're automatically acting as the leader, that's really important when it comes time for promotion and the bosses are looking around at who can take control. It's the guy who's already been taking control.
When you are in a room, obviously, you know, people walk in, they look at you and they think to themselves, if they don't say it out loud, they think, wow, she's really tall. Do you look down at the rest of us and say, wow, they're all really average size?
No, I look down at them and say, please don't tell me that I'm tall, please. There's three questions that tall people are constantly asked. It's how tall are you? How tall are your parents? And do you play basketball? And I think that a good rule of thumb is that compliments are always welcome, but please don't ask me how tall I am.
The book by Ariane Cohen is called The Tall Book. She's 6'3", by the way. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, courtesy of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. Remember yesterday, in announcing the TARP paybacks, the White House observed that taxpayers had made almost $2 billion in interest on the deal so far, right? Let us now flip to another page in the government's balance sheet. The Federal Reserve revealed today that in the first quarter, we all collectively lost $5.25 billion on the investments the Fed made last year in AIG and Bear Stearns on our behalf. Total loss so far on a pile of debt that is at least partially made up of some of those mortgage-backed securities gone bad that started this whole thing? More than $16 billion. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow fell 24 points, a quarter of 1%. The Nasdaq dropped 7 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 lost 3 points. That's about a third percent there as well. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gwartz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Thanks today to the staff here at Minnesota Public Radio. Coming up next time on the broadcast, rating stocks may get riskier.
The big question is whether or not those independent research firms have discovered a business model that will enable them to stay in business.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.